Psalm 68, a lot of introduction to this one. It's a hymn of victory in the style of Exodus 15, which is a hymn of victory after the crossing of the Red Sea, so you can look at it later. So this is in the similar style. The Exodus event explains many elements of the hymn and its development. For example, the presence of God in Sinai will be behind this hymn. It's celebrating the same thing. The departure, the advance through the wilderness, the rebellion of some who died in the desert will be mentioned, and you'll find that in Numbers 14. The resistance by some kings, the kings of Moab and Bashan, Og the king of Moab and... Speaks with an S, I can't think of it. The king of Bashan. In fact, by the way, archaeology has shown that Bashan didn't have inhabitants at the time of Moses. So... you've got to be careful. You're not reading history when you read the Old Testament. You're reading homily material, liturgical material, which is there to talk about, like the Irish, for God's sake. My father told me I'm descended from the kings of Ireland. I felt quite important. And then I found out later there were kings on every hill. Anyhow, it just meant... it probably meant the local bully or something, I don't know. So anyhow, the point is, you know, the stuff of Brian Boru and King Arthur and... but these stories don't say nothing. The Homer, what an influence Homer must have had on the Greek psyche. For good, not for good, I suppose, but basically... so this, we're dealing with a kind of literature that is... gaining the minds of people in a way that's dramatically powerful, with a view to stirring them to love God, to be just, to be truthful, to, you know, care for the widow and the orphan and remember the past. And so a lot of it is legend, but it's legend brought in and history kind of, not history, created, like I suppose the Aboriginal myths do that too, surely. I think everyone does it. And it's an okay thing to do within limits, but it's not modern history. So here, resistance by some kings. At the end, that's what the advantage, by the way, of archaeology is such a great help to us, because it helps us relax back and realise what we're doing. We're dealing with drama here, not historical fact, revealed by God to somebody 800 years after the event. I mean, it's bizarre. Does God ever come down to anybody on this earth and reveal things that happened 800 years ago? I know there are visionaries who write, you know, what... there are books even written on the New Testament that are supposed to be better than the New Testament. That, I won't go into names, but all the things that Jesus said and all the things that Jesus said, oh, treat them with the utmost care. They're probably the psychological projections of a saintly person who might have been a Rhineland mystic of the whatever century, and it's her prayer, and it may be quite lovely, but read it the way you read... what's that thing that's just come out now about the Da Vinci Code? Yes. I mean, it's kind of prayer, and it might even help you a little bit, but don't take it as fact. And don't take private revelation ever as fact, because... private revelations, you've got to be so careful of them, haven't you? Because they, even if Mary did appear and does appear to people, and of course, that, I'm not saying that doesn't happen, that'd be foolish. But if Mary appears, Mary doesn't talk. Mary doesn't say things. Mary appears, it's apophatic, it's beyond words. It's an experience of communion that is wonderful. But if, say, Mary appeared to me with this wonderful experience, then I put the words on it, you know. I'm the one that... it's human thoughts that are coming. So they're all mine. Or the Franciscan priest I happened to visit and tell him about this vision I've had. And so it'll end up being a Bosnian or a... is it, where is it exactly? Medjugorje, what's it? Where is it though? It's Croatian. It's, you'll find it's very, very reflecting a Croatian mentality of the church. Same in Portugal, for God's sake. The kids will... they got to see... how else can you do it except see it your way? So revelations remind us of important things. So once the revelations happen, you forget about it immediately. John of the Cross will tell you this. the revelations that you receive in prayer, anything beyond the normal, paranormal experiences. If you've had it, the grace happens in the receiving of it. What you do then is you absolutely forget it. Because if you go back to it and start remembering it, you start focusing on the revelation and not on God. You start on the words rather than the reality. So it's done its job, so you get on with your life. And don't talk about it. Otherwise you end up being the centre. You're following me, aren't you? There's dangers in all this stuff. So if it reminds you of something beautiful, go back to what's beautiful. And you'll find that beautiful thing in the community of the church, and you'll find it in the scriptures. You'll find it in those most safe documents that have stood the test of 2,000 years of sanctity. That's their aim. And their aim is for the person who receives the revelation. And maybe it'll affect other people, like Margaret Mary and the revelations of Jesus of the Sacred Heart. But the devotion to the Sacred Heart goes back to the earliest centuries. And in Margaret Mary's time, the heart became just a bit physical, a bit French. A bit French of that century, you know, a bit perhaps feminine, you know. Naturally, what else can it be? So you've got to treat all the... Anyhow, I'm on the high horse now. But come back to our text. Read things with great care. And the beauty of Catholicism, as I see it, is that I belong to a community of real people, and you must stay in contact with these real people. They're sinners, like me, they're saints, like I'd like to be, but there's a whole range of us, but it's in the community and in an all-embracing community that allows everybody in. The right wing and the left wing and the centre and all the squawking and all that. We've all got a place, and if we listen to each other in the light of our the magisterium, the teaching of our church, then we're in a very beautiful place. I will be with you always to the end of time. If we go back and make the book our centre and lock ourselves in those books, we've got big problems. So stay together, listen to each other, trust the Spirit in your ordinary life, etc. Back to our text, or our introduction to the text. At the end of the journey, they found a cultivated and irrigated land. You find that in Deuteronomy 11, which was divided up, and you find that all in the book of Joshua, and in which the people settled. So that's background, all of it sung, celebrated in our Psalm 68. Psalm 68 takes this up to the building of the temple as God's dwelling in the Holy Land. It's modelled also on the victory song of Deborah, at the period of the Judges. And this Deborah in Judge 5, Yahweh, when you went out from Seir, that's a part of Edom, when you marched from the region of Edom, the earth trembled and the heavens poured, the clouds indeed poured water. The mountains quaked before Yahweh of Sinai, before Yahweh, the God of Israel. So with that background, and a little too much talk from me, I'm sorry. Let's start with verse 1. Let God rise up. Let his enemies be scattered. Let those who hate him flee before him. As smoke disappears, so let them disappear. As wax melts before the fire, let the wicked perish before God. A comment from the book of Numbers, chapter 10. Whenever the ark set out, Moses would say, Arise, Yahweh. Let God rise up. Arise, Yahweh. Let your enemies be scattered and your foes flee before you. And whenever it came to rest, he would say, Return, Yahweh, of the 10,000s of Israel. 10,000 is their biggest number. So 10 is full, you know. So 10,000s is their way of saying Verse 3. Of our psalm. But let the just be joyful. The just. Good word. Be joyful. Let them exult before Yahweh, before God. Let them be jubilant with joy. Sing to God, make music in his honor. Lay down a road for him who gallops over the plain. His name is Yah. Be exultant before him. As you know, almost always, the name for God is Yahweh, isn't it? It's four letters. But sometimes they just put the two, quite rarely, and whenever it does, I'll just put Yah. In fact, you have it in the word Alleluia. Yeah. Hallel is praise. Hallelujah, let us praise. Yah. Yah is the... And you find it in many, many names. Jeremiah. The J is a Y in Hebrew. So Judith. No, not Judith. Yeah, that would be. Would it be? Judah. I'm not sure of that one. What are some words? Elijah. The A-H. Elisha. Azariah. You know, it's the A at the end. Yah. I-A. Or J-A. Or Y-A is always this name of God. So, back to his name is Yah. Be exultant before him. And here's how they define God. Beautiful and very father of orphans and protector of widows is God in his holy habitation. I was surprised many years ago now when I was doing my thesis in Rome on a subject that interested me, and I explored it all through, and I found very frequently in the Greek writings, Zeus is called father of orphans and protector of widows, which I didn't expect. So it's not just a Hebrew awareness. There's something in the psyche of somewhere else too. I've never followed that right through to be able to draw conclusions from it, but I did find that to my surprise. Father of orphans, protector of widows, is God in his holy habitation. Job chapter 29 reflects, I delivered the poor who cried, the orphan who had no helper. The blessing of the wretched came upon me, and I caused the widow's heart to sing for joy. So there is this lovely sense, isn't there, in Judaism, at its best, and that's the best way to look at any religion. Judaism's best is very aware of God's care for the slave and the poor and the oppressed because of their own experience of being slaves in Egypt. But most of the people, like we can be the same, live their religion without that awareness and have to keep being reminded of it as we do. Here's verse 6. God gives the desolate a home to live in. He leads out the prisoners to prosperity and the rebellious live in a parched land. I couldn't help thinking, and it must be behind the drama of the New Testament. Why did Peter, that's Peter's gospel, the end of chapter 1 have this beautiful scene of the leper? Well, leper is not a good word, because from my best understanding, leprosy, what's it technically called? Hansen's disease, did exist at the time of Jesus in the Middle East period, but it was very recent there. Whenever you talk about leprosy in the Old Testament, it certainly wasn't leprosy. It didn't exist there. So there's a problem with the word lepra in Greek. It basically means someone with a virulent skin complaint. It might happen to be leprosy, but it's too general. It may not be. And in the case of Jesus, it couldn't be, because you can't suddenly be cured of leprosy, I don't think. Leprosy can be controlled, but what leprosy has done doesn't get reverted, does it? I mean, if you've lost your hand, you've lost your hand, I think. So I imagine the time, we're talking about whatever it was Jesus is holding, and a person who, we're psychosomatic beings. Maybe I'm too cynical, or no, too sceptical might be, yeah, I don't know what. Careful might be a nicer word for me. I just think when you look at the miracles of Jesus, once again, you're seeing the text is a dramatic text, a symbolic text. Behind it would be something. So I imagine that behind the miracles of Jesus, all you have is what love can do. Because God is love. Now, I don't know the limits of love, but I'm sure that if my psyche is, if I'm loved, that will have a lot of healing on a lot of parts of my body and my psyche, of course, won't it? If we weren't loved, we'd all be very sick. So love is a wonderful healing, but it won't heal everything. If you lose a leg from a road accident, you've lost your leg. But there are a lot of healing. No, that's where I am. I hope I'm there humbly, I'm not sure, but I don't see Jesus as not a magician, so But that Jesus love would be so powerful that it would bring psychic and somatic healing to many people, of course. I don't know, that doesn't surprise me at all. And I think that must be our focus. Or we get distracted from love onto something else. It doesn't happen now, you know? And we think, why did it happen then? It doesn't happen now and all that. Because Jesus said, you will do greater things yet. So there are greater things happening today than Jesus ever did, according to John's Gospel. There are, too. And Jesus just lived a very short life in a very small place, and there was a lot of lack of faith. And whenever he healed anyone, remember the words, he said, your faith healed you. In other words, you welcome the love, so you're healed. But don't despair if you're not healed, because you might have a heart problem that love can't heal. But love can heal you in the sense of accepting and heaven, after all, is the final miracle. Now, there's a lot more to it than that I don't understand, but I'm just sharing with you as far as I go. But there's the leper. The desolate have a home to live in. The leads prisoners. The leper was a prisoner of the community, locked into this situation that he was in, and Jesus embraced him. And Deuteronomy said, you can't touch lepers. And Jesus, of course he touched them. So did God say you can't? No wonder they crucified Jesus. If you're a fundamentalist, really, you'd have to crucify Jesus. And that's what fundamentalists are still doing, crucifying Jesus-like people. That's what happens. Because they're not... Jesus used to say, go and learn the meaning of the words. Go and learn the meaning of the words. I want love, not sacrifice. That beautiful, that lovely scene of the deranged man on the eastern side of the lake. Remember that? It was a scene I, you know, read for years, but once at university 30 years ago now, one day if I get the energy, or someone else has the energy, I'd like to use that part up the top of our church where the lectern is for dramatising the gospel. I've got this little thought, but I haven't got the energy to do anything about it yet. But I actually think if we dramatise, I'll tell you why. This scene, you know, of the man, you remember the man, okay. And I was watching, I was just sitting down there, and we had one young man with hair all over the place, that was how he was. So we thought we'd make him the deranged man, because he looked the part. And then this was the time when they demanded that Jesus be a woman, because, you know, so I thought, oh, well, okay, we'll give in to that too. So we had half the, this is all 70s. So half the disciples were women, half the disciples were men, and Jesus actually was a woman, and that's all right. For the drama. I wasn't going to fight them all over all these equal opportunities and stuff. And I was sitting where you are, and here was Jesus, and there was... You know how the story ends? It says, he says he wants to come with Jesus, and Jesus says, no, go back to your own people and tell them the wonders that God has done for you. And that kind of feels a bit hard. But here was Jesus, and over here was the disciples, about to go off in the boat. There was the deranged man who'd been cured, centre stage, and over there were the crowd, trying to get rid of Jesus. Now go away, we don't want you. And it was wonderful just sitting there watching, because what happened, just the drama showed me Jesus was looking at the man and looking at the crowd. And he was really saying, you're healed, you're okay. I'd love you to come with me, but I want you to do something. I want you to go back to those people, because they've got the problem. They're the real people who are locked in, not you. You've faced your problems, you've been healed, you're the drug addict, you know, who's got out of drugs. Go back to the kids in drugs and tell them what it's like, you know. In other words, he was rather than saying, go back, and rejecting him, he's actually saying to him, you've got a mission. He loves him so much that he's given him something to do that only he can do, because he knows these people. Anyhow, whatever about that. But that stayed in my mind and a lot of other things, making me think if we could dramatise the gospel, another part of our brain gets involved, and we actually see the gospel. Have to be well done, and I'll stop distracting you and me on that. We'll go. But it is a little thought I've got. The text goes on, verse 7. The theophanies in the desert anticipate nurturing rain in the province land. So here we are. Oh God, when you went out at the head of your people, when you marched through the wilderness, the earth quaked, the heavens poured down rain, and at the presence of God, the God of Sinai, at the presence of God, the God of Israel. Rain in abundance, O God, you showered abroad. You restored your heritage when it languished. Your flock found a dwelling in it. In your goodness, O God, you provided for the needy. And the text goes on now, likening God to a victorious general. The Lord sounds the war cry. Great is the company of those who bear the tidings. Kings, armies, they flee. Houses and farms are divided as spoil, and you stay among the sheepfolds. Houses and farms are divided as spoil, and you stay among the sheepfolds. I think that's the meaning of it. Why don't you come and enjoy the victory and join in the spoils and stop bleating your way away in the sheepfolds? And then the wings of a dove covered with silver, its pinions with green gold. I'm not sure what that means. The scholars suggest that it might be the conquered military standards. You know, that when you've conquered the army and they've got the flag and standard. And so this is, and they've got reasons for that, so I'll accept that as the most probable reasoning. And when the Almighty scattered kings, snow fell on Zalmon. Now, Zalmon happens to mean Black Mountain in Hebrew. The only other place you find it is in Judges 9:48, when it's clearly a mountain in the vicinity of Shechem. But here, it's got to be up somewhere near Bashan. But you can have a Black Mountain in Canberra, can't you? Yeah. You can have a... And is there a Black Mountain anywhere else? Local? They're all over the place, eh? So, more than one Black Mountain. Zalmon, anyhow, means Black Mountain. O mighty mountain, mountain of Bashan. Bashan, you know where that is. That's the, what do they call it now? The part that Syria occupy. That's the Golan Heights. That's Bashan. Thank you. O many-peaked mountain, mountains of Bashan. It's the fertile area in the upper Transjordan east of the Sea of Galilee and north of the Yarmouk River. Golan Heights will do. Why do you look with envy, O many-peaked mountain, at the mountain that God selected for his abode? In other words, why is God's temple on this little mountain in Jerusalem, which has got towering, if you've been there, the Jordan, on the other side of the Jordan, the mountains are quite, or even the Mount of Olives is much higher. So why didn't God choose the mighty mountains of the north? You know, is the point. At the mountain that God selected, Yahweh will reside there forever. The chariots of the Lord by the thousand, tens of thousands of archers. The Lord came from Sinai to his holy place. Here's an interesting text in itself, but it's also interesting when you're reading the New Testament to see how non-fundamentalistic is the New Testament. I've probably said this before and I hope I don't bore you. Fundamentalism is essentially a modern phenomenon. There are no fundamentalists prior to the modern era. Fundamentalism, it requires an insight that is then neglected to exist. I'll try and say it again. If you go back when people thought the earth was the centre of the cosmos, which was not that long ago, and they talked about the sun rising and the sun setting, which is actually, from a physical point of view, you'd have to say something better than that. You'd have to talk about the spinning of the earth and all that kind of thing. They saw life as it looked, and they thought the stars were only small, so the stars could fall from heaven and hit the earth, but they'd only be tiny. They didn't realise what they were doing. Is that all right? So if you go back into that mentality, and that's not difficult to imagine, I don't think, then you would look at the world in a certain way, and you'd see it in a certain way, and you'd talk in a certain way, and that's fine. Everybody did, and you're imagining. You think, you're not making statements that contradict fact. You're just looking at things the way you see them. Now comes Copernicus and all the rest of them, and you come to the knowledge that, no, wait a minute, the earth is not the centre of the universe. The earth is spinning, and that's why, rather than the heavens spinning around the earth, we're doing this. It gets all very complicated, doesn't it? Once you know that, and that the earth is not flat, the earth is a round globe, you've had an insight. You know... and the sun is spinning around the earth. You're in a different place to you were before, aren't you? You're now in a place where you are, for insecurity reasons, for whatever reasons you might have, you're actually in the face of insight that everybody has, you're making statements that are absolutely indefensible. So you've actually chosen to choose a point of view that cannot anymore be held, and it's quite different from the point of view that people had before here when they didn't have the insight. Am I being kind of clear? So what happened at the time of the Enlightenment, so we're going into the 17th century period or a bit earlier and then that period, is that people started, thank God, to make discretionary discernments. They started to think in terms of history, drama, literary forms. They started to, physical world, the empirical sciences, demanded a kind of a categorizing of knowledge and an awareness of the different levels of the psyche and different ways of looking at life, different slots, if you like, that you can put things into. I haven't said all that too clearly, but I think you follow my point. Once the human mind has seen these distinctions and starts to think of history separate from drama or mythology or legend, and you know, is able to make these discernments, which is a very important development of the human mind, once you've done that, after it, if because you want the Bible to be true, you lock it into fact. You see what you've done? And that's understandable, because the Bible was being attacked by all these people who said, well, it can't be true because the earth couldn't be made in 7 days and because we must be more than 40,000 years old. And they were good statements being made. Of course, but then a lot of people, most people, who didn't yet know how in the early days, didn't yet know where to put the Bible being true, except in the level of fact. They started to defend it as fact. So, yeah, Noah did this, there was an ark. Now, that was all right for a while. What people were basically doing was trying to defend the truth of the Bible, and they didn't know how to do it very well, which is perfectly understandable. Now, we know how to do it very well. We've learned a whole lot about Near Eastern religions and literature and archaeology has discovered and new languages. And so we're in a totally new position to be able to see the beauty and the truth, that truth, like Shakespeare can be true, poetry can be true, can't they? You don't have to be factual to be true. So we're in a position to do that. Fundamentalism is the refusal to come to terms with the distinctions that the mind is making and to look at the real truth, but through insecurity, keeps locking the Bible into a position of fact. Whereas people prior to these distinctions, I'll finish now because I think I've said it as clear as I can. Prior to these distinctions, people thought perhaps more like a child would think still, who doesn't distinguish between tooth fairy and fat. Like it's all part of a global world that's where imagination, feeling, symbolism, it's a beautiful kind of world, but it's not yet able to make these distinctions. And once the child has learned, which we can now teach, to make these distinctions, they should be quite peaceful about it all. So you can let Santa Claus go when you're about 6 or 7 now, whereas maybe I couldn't until I was about 9 or whatever. Have I made my point reasonably? It's so that it's quite a modern phenomenon, and it has no. So, where did I get to? Oh, this text. Look how Paul used the text. Here's the text. You ascended the high mount, verse 18 of Psalm 68. You ascended the high mount, leading captives in your train, receiving peoples, rebels as tribute. The image is perfectly obvious. God goes up to the high mountain, and he is the victorious general, and all the captive kings, chains around their necks, you know, dragged along behind the chariots, are coming and they're giving tribute to this victorious king. People, women, kids, possessions, horses, or whatever they're offering in tribute. That's the scene. Paul quotes it, goes back to this scene to talk about Jesus ascending into heaven. And this is the text. But look what he does. When he ascended on high, Christ going into heaven, he made captivity itself a captive, leading captives in your train. But what Jesus captured was captivity. Captivity, people being locked into prisons, you know, that was gone. That was now captured, overwhelmed, overcome, so that we're free. We're free from all these captives, mainly the sin thing, which is the worst thing. But look how he says it. He gave gifts to his people. He turns the text around. In the text, the king is receiving gifts. But Paul wants to go back to this text, but play with it, like a child plays with a fountain. And he says, instead of that, he has the risen Christ, rather than receiving tribute, giving it. And that's the gift of the Holy Spirit, poured out on the church and giving gifts to people. So he's, I can't say it better than that. He's actually quoting, he's alluding to, is that a better word? But this is the image he's using, but he's quite happy to turn it, to play with it, to twist it around, because he's not, his security isn't in the written text. His security is in the truth revealed within the written text. And now it's been transformed. It's more beautiful now. Rather than our king receiving tribute, our king is giving his spirit to the whole world. So, of course, he adapts it. You'll often find that in the New Testament. When you go back to the Old Testament to find the text Paul uses or someone else uses, you don't find it exactly the same in the text. Why would it be exactly the same? Jesus has happened in the meantime. So you improve the text. It's a living statement that's now much more real and can be improved. You took up your position there, O Yah. Here it is again, God. Blessed be the Lord who daily bears us up. God takes charge of our salvation. God is for us, our Saviour God. It is up to Yahweh the Lord to liberate from death. God will shatter the heads of his enemies, the hairy crown of those who walk in their sinful ways. Verse 22. The Lord said, I will bring them back from Bashan. I will bring them back from the depths of the sea, so that you may bathe your feet in blood, so that the tongues of your dogs may have their share of the foe. There we are. Okay, just enjoy it. Sometimes you feel like that. They're not words I can imagine Jesus praying, but there it is. Here's Amos. Though they dig into Sheol, the underworld, from there shall my hand take them. Though they climb up to heaven, from there I will bring them down. Though they hide themselves on top of Carmel, from there I will search out and take them. And though they hide from my sight at the bottom of the sea, there I will command the sea serpent, it shall bite them. So you can't get away from God. Now we would say, I don't want to get away from God. I hope I never do. Thanks be to God. But with their view of God, that meant, you know, well, we've heard it all before. Behave yourself, or God will be angry with you and God will punish you. Yeah, zap you. And finally, this psalm ends with a solemn procession. It's probably the only psalm that is actually kind of acted out in the actual temple. These are little instructions given for the acting, the play. They're playing out the victory of Sinai and God's conquering of the Egyptians and all that heroic stuff that's... Well, after all, if you read the book of Exodus, Pharaoh and all his army were destroyed in the Red Sea. Now, that's marvellous, except that we don't know any Pharaoh who ever drowned in the Red Sea, and we've got a bit of information about them all. And after all, this was the most famous of them all, Ramses II, who, don't know, he died as an old man, and I think he was in bed. You know, he might have been poisoned, I wouldn't know what happened to him. But he didn't die in the Red Sea. So, relax, everybody. But this is what they're, you know, they got across, do you get it? They're dramatising. So this is all about that, and their victory, and how they're going to be looked after, and it concludes, your cortege makes its appearance, O God, the solemn procession of my God, my King, into the sanctuary. Like Palm Sunday, we're going to act it out. The singers in front, the musicians last, and between them girls playing tambourines. Good old girls, bring your tambourines. Bless God in the great congregation, the Lord in the assembly of Israel. There is Benjamin, the least of them, in the lead. Why would Benjamin be in the lead? And who was the first king?
Saul.
Saul was from Benjamin. Maybe this was composed at the time when Saul was the king. I don't know. But Benjamin was there, and the reason why Saul was chosen as their first king was because he couldn't do anything without everybody agreeing. Because Joseph and Judah squashed in little Benjamin. So he was a compromise candidate who would be controlled from the north and the south, hence the king. It didn't last too long because of various things, but there we are. There's Benjamin, the least of them, in the lead, the princes of Judah in great numbers, and the princes of Zebulun, the princes of Naphtali. Verse 28. Command, O God, according to your authority, show your strength, O God, as you have done for us before. From your temple in Jerusalem, kings bear tribute to you. Rebuke the wild animals that live among the reeds, the herd of bulls, the calves of the peoples. They fall prostrate before you with bars of gold. Scatter the peoples who delight in war. Let bronze be brought from Egypt. Let Cush, that is Nubia, southern part of southern higher Egypt, hasten to stretch out its hands to God. And concludes, sing to God, O kingdoms of the earth. Sing praises to the Lord, who rides through the heavens, the ancient heavens, causing his mighty voice to thunder. Acknowledge God's power. His majesty is over Israel. His authority is above the clouds. Awesome is God in his sanctuary, the God of Israel. He gives power and strength to his people. And the psalm ends, blessed be God.